obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name is John Brown, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, John Brown.
And I had a friend named Frank Honeycutt. When he got nervous, he said he felt like a good girl in a bad place. And I kind of feel like a good girl in a bad place right now. So I'd first like to thank Billy and the committee for giving me this honor to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. It's a privilege and an honor to be here. I'd like to thank my wife, who has been on this journey with us for me. We've been married 28 years this year, and I know she's going to heaven, and I'm still working on it. And I'd like to thank some of the men that came up from Long Beach. You know, I'm very fortunate to be a sponsor to a number of men. And, you know, three men that came up here today, one guy's name is Chris, and when I met Chris 7 years ago, you know, he was a mess. And in that last 7 years, you know, he became the first member of his family to get sober, and he started a little business, and his mother got sick, and he takes care of his mother. I have another friend named Jamie who came out from Boston, and you know, he came out here and got a job and started to take care of business and got a great career today and just got engaged to be married. And I have a friend, Billy, who had 3 years and went back out, but you know, was back in now and got married, has a little baby girl. And you know, and they have the look of Alcoholics Anonymous in their eyes. And I know for a fact that if you ever want to know what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, then just work with somebody and watch them get it. There's nothing better, there's nothing more rewarding than to pass on what was so freely given to me to somebody else. And I'm grateful that I get a chance to do that, and I'm grateful for their friendship. Yeah, I don't know when it's too late to wish everybody Happy New Year, but hell, Happy New Year. I think tomorrow's the cutoff, so after tomorrow, I'm sorry, the next speaker cannot do it. And you know, I had a great New Year's. I went up. My wife's mother is 96 years old, and she lives in Boise, Idaho. And we went up to Boise, Idaho to spend New Year's with her. And I will tell you that over the last 2 years, she's not been doing too well. But for 16 out of the last 19 years, on New Year's Eve, I would take her to the Seal Beach Speakers AA New Year's dance, and I would dance with my mother-in-law. And it was so cool because I'd have all the guys I sponsor line up to dance with this little old lady, and she thought she was the shit that day, I gotta tell you, man. She'd be dancing, smiling, and then some guy would go dance with another girl, and my wife would go, why is she dancing with that fat girl? Vanity to the end. And on New Year's Eve this year, I went to that assisted living home, and we put a little music on, and her and I danced on New Year's Eve again. And it was wonderful. And that night in Boise, Idaho, they had the first annual potato drop for New Year's Eve. And I got to tell you something. You know, I'm from New York City. I grew up in the Bronx. If anybody would have suggested at any time in my adult life that I would go watch a potato drop, I probably would have punched them in the face. Because my ego and my mind would never have allowed me to do something like that. And instead, you guys have taught me that my ego is not my amigo, and to go out there and to try something different, which is what I've been trying to do for the last 19 years. And my daughter flew into town, and we went down to watch this 40-foot potato drop out of a crane into the middle of 5,000 people, and it was one of the best times I've ever had. You know, when I take contrary action to what's going on in my head, it is absolutely amazing how great my life is. It's absolutely amazing when I stop listening to this and start doing the things that I need to do. Because I'm a selfish man. If there's something not in it for me, I don't want to do it. You know, when I was new, a speaker came up and told this story about this guy that was driving through the mountain, and it was raining that night, and he had no cell phone service, and his car started sputtering. He pulled over to the side of the road. He was driving. He saw this house with the light on. About a half a mile later, he pulled over to the side of the road. His car broke down, and there was no cell phone. And he goes, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And he goes, oh, I remember that house. I'm going to go, and maybe the guy will let me use his phone. So he gets out in the rain, and he starts walking in the rain, and he gets a little closer. He goes, wow, I'm sure this man will help me. He goes a little further. He goes, well, what if this man won't help me? Goes a little further, he goes, you know, somebody, I don't think that son of a bitch is going to help me. Gets to the door, knocks on the door. The guy goes, can I help you? He goes, F you, I don't need your help. And he walks away. And I got to tell you, that described my thinking for a very, very long time before I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My ego got in the way in so, so many things. I never knew that the disease of alcoholism started in my brain. See, I didn't know that for most of my life, I didn't feel that I was worthy or that I was worth it. I went through my life with such low self-esteem, never understanding why I felt the way I did. I never understand why it was so important for you to like me. All the things I did to get you to like me, even if it meant looking like a jackass, which was my nickname for many years in Alcoholics Anonymous from my first sponsor. My sobriety date is March 9th, 1995. My home group is the Monday night Seal Beach Speakers Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the absolute best meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't feel that way about your home group, I suggest you come to mine. I have two sponsors, one named Doug S. and Lynn W. And those men have guided me over the last few years to really show me how to become a man. And I'm grateful for their sponsorship and their tutelage. Alcoholics Anonymous, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys have taken me and turned me into a man that I never knew I could ever be. You took this broken man when I came in here at the age of 35 years old, and you turned him into something that I sometimes got to look over and take a look at to make sure it's still me. And it wasn't that way for me. You know, I grew up in New York City. I think this is the ex-New York City weekend here, you know. Ruth spoke today, and Marty spoke from New Jersey last night, and I grew up in the Bronx. And I'm the eldest of five kids. And my mother was born in Ireland, and my father was a sweet-talking guy from Brooklyn. And when my mother was the second oldest of 11 children, and at 17 years old, she bought a one-way ticket to New York City because she wanted a better life. And, you know, I got to remember the struggles we have and the people that helped me get to where I am. And I was my mother's apple of her eye. My mother could never have been more loved than any man could ever be loved by his mother. And I was a mama's boy for a very long time. You know, in my house, my father drank, he worked two jobs, they had five kids, there always seemed to be some sort of struggle going on, always seemed to be some sort of argument. But I learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that my father and mother did the very best job that they could. And as the years went on, you know, that stress and that anxiety started to come in. And I think there was a lot more drink. I know there was a lot more drinking. My uncle was a bartender, and at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, he would show up with two shopping bags full of beer. My father would get up, start playing the harmonica. My mother and her brother would start dancing in the kitchen. We'd get up in our underwears, singing Irish songs for money, which I'm really pissed that no karaoke tonight because I can really sing a few songs. And I thought that type of life was normal. I thought everybody came in and started drinking at 6 in the morning. Everybody hit their uncle up for 10 bucks at 7 years old. It just seemed to make sense to me. But the problem was, the disease of alcoholism was well, well, well in my family. And I've learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I had the disease of alcoholism way before I took a first drink. Because as these things are going on, things aren't just normal in my house. You know, the bills aren't getting paid all the time. There's not enough food in the fridge. I know my father worked two jobs and, you know, to do everything he can to put his kids through private Catholic school because he wanted a good life for us. There was never enough money. And there was always that struggle, that pain. And how my mother and father coped with their problems, what they drank. And it just seemed that the drinking started to get worse and worse and worse in my house. And I want you to know that I know that coming from an alcoholic home didn't make me an alcoholic. I know the disease of alcoholism started when I took a drink and I couldn't put that drink down. And I know that no children should be raised in a house where two crazy alcoholics are going. But that's just the way life is. And I'm living this life now, and I'm, you know, there's some anxiety, and again, I told you I'm a mama's boy, so I'm doing anything I can to make my mother happy. And at about 10, 11 years old, she asked me to go downtown. You know, we lived in the Bronx, and my father worked in the Empire State Building. And she goes, I need you to go downtown and get your father's paycheck before he spends it. So as a 10, 11-year-old boy, I got on the D train, got off at 34th Street, went in and said, hey, Dad, I need to take the money home. Mom needs it. He goes, yeah, I'll be right back. And, you know, I didn't see him again. And I would come home utterly ashamed and defeated. I realized that was this demoralization that I let my mother down. Next week I go down, and next week, and next week, and next thing you know, I'm starting to get a little smarter than him. And I've been doing this now for a couple of years and finally outsmarting my father. You see, my father had a bar tab at the Blarney Stone, and he had to get his paycheck, get it cashed there, pay off his debt, and then whatever money was left, he'd bring home. And he didn't do that because he didn't love his children, because I know today that my father loved his children. He didn't do that because he didn't love my mother. He did it because he needed to have a drink of alcohol every single day so he can feel like he was part of. You know, and it's tough when you're a kid understanding that. And it's tough for me to understand that because at 12 years old, you know, I started my first drink at 12 years old. And let me rephrase that. I had a drink before 12 years old, but at 12 years old is when I started to really start to look to have a drink. And by the time I'm 13 years old now, we're partying every weekend. By the time I'm 14 years old, I'm looking now to start stealing money. So I'm going down, picking that paycheck up, and I'm getting my father because I'm a little smarter than him. And I'd get that paycheck, and I would take a little extra money out from me for my drinking and blame it on my father. And when my father got home that night, my mother would lay into him, "How can you do that?" He goes, "I didn't do that." And they'd call my name. I said, "Yes, you did." And I'd lie to his face. Didn't know how to deal with that. You know, the disease of alcoholism, when I was a young man, I learned coping skills that I thought were the tools to help me survive, to deal with that pain and anxiety. I learned skills on how to lie, how to manipulate. I learned skills on how to steal so I can start to feel a little bit more. Why wasn't I feeling good? Why didn't I fit in? Why was I always angry? As a young man, I had this huge chip on my shoulder, and I was starting to get into fights now. And, you know, and when I was 15 years old, I went to my first high school, and because of some extra criminal activity, I got kicked out of my first high school at 15. By the time I was 16 years old, I got kicked out of my second high school. And before the end of my 16th birthday, I got kicked out of three high schools, and I dropped out of school. And from then, I went from this good Catholic boy going to Catholic school with crew cuts and gray uniforms to long hair, bandana, and just not caring. You know, for most of my life, I felt that I was stuck. I didn't know how to get unstuck. For most of my life, I felt that whatever my life was that day was going to be my life for the rest of my life. When I was a young man and I'm drinking and using now, I am not dreaming about anything. I'm not dreaming about college. I'm dreaming about where am I going to get a union job so I can get some money, so I can maybe get some benefits. If I ever had a family, they'd be taken care of. Because that's all we looked for. You know, when you're living in an alcoholic home, when you're living in craziness, nobody's thinking about going to college. Nobody's thinking about saving money. Nobody's thinking about tomorrow. It's all about today. My whole life, until the day I got sober, was all about today. I had to take care of John today. And I didn't understand that because that's all I ever knew. And at 16 years old, I'm starting to get arrested now. And I'm starting to get arrested for stupid stuff. Petty theft, fighting in public, drunk in public. But it was getting more and more and more. And at 17, my father said, "You know, maybe you should join the army. It'll make a man out of you." I said, "Like it made a man out of you?" You know, I hated him. And, you know, I grew up hating this man. See, by now, my mother is a daily drinker. And what I have to do is I have to go get her booze so I can get some money to do my own thing. My father is, we were the superintendents of a building. When he comes home, he's not even talking to his kids anymore. He's sitting in the boiler drinking his beer because he didn't have to deal with anything. And he'd come out after he get loaded and start screaming at everybody. And this madness was going on for such a long time. At 17, he said, "Maybe you should join the Navy." And I went down to join the Navy. And I didn't really want to join the Navy, but it felt like it was such a good thing to do. And the next day, before going down to Swearin, I got a job unloading trucks at Pathmark in Co-op City. And I didn't go into the armed forces. And now I got this little job. And all that little job was doing was just to give me enough money to keep doing what I wanted to do. Just keep me enough to take that pain away. And unbeknownst to me at the time, there was no God in my life. You see, when I was growing up with a God that I knew I was going to hell with. I was told at 5 years old, "You're going to hell." I was told at 7 years old, "You're going to hell." I had these unbelievably crazy aunts and uncles who were so Catholic that anything you did, you were going to hell. If I wasn't going to hell, I was going to spend the rest of my life in purgatory. You know? And I believed it. When you're a little boy and you love the people around you, you believe what they tell you. And I got this mother now, and I don't know, you know, I know there's a lot of people out here, women who are mothers who are drunk, but when you're raised with a drunk mother, your heart gets broken because the promises get broken over and over and over. And my heart was broken, and I didn't know it. All that pain that I carried with me was all anger. I'm fighting every day now. I'm getting in trouble all the time. By the time I was 21 years old, I was arrested 20-odd times for miscellaneous stuff. Fortunately, I didn't go to jail. I went to jail on the weekends. I didn't have to do any real time. And I met this girl. And this girl was beautiful. You know, she was from the right side of town, and that means if you live in the Bronx, the right side of town, and she had a car and you didn't. And I had this girl who was beautiful, had a car, and her and I started this love affair, and it was magic. You know, I just finally was able to put my attention and my focus somewhere. And after about a year of dating her, and, you know, she got pregnant. And she said, you know, John, I think you have a drug and drinking problem. Will you go to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? And at 18 years old, I was introduced to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978. And I went in, and I looked around. I was 18 years old, and back in the Bronx, St. Philip Neri's, there's still a meeting there today. There was a bunch of old Irish guys with white hair and big red noses. That's all I remember. And I went in, and they sat me down like good old-timers do. Sit down, kid, shut up, blah, blah, blah. And they read how it worked, and in the middle of how it worked, I gave them the finger, and I walked out. There was absolutely no way I was an alcoholic. You know, I might be a liar, I might cheat a little bit, I might do this, but I could not concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. You see, my whole life, I knew what an alcoholic was. My whole life, my brother, my mother was an alcoholic, my father was an alcoholic, my uncle was an alcoholic, the guy in the street was an alcoholic. But when I looked at myself in the mirror, I knew there was something wrong, but I could not concede to my innermost self that was me. And 2 weeks before that baby was going to be born, she came to me and she says, you know, John, you're going to be an unfit father, and we need to give that baby up for adoption. And she goes, I don't want you to fight me. I just want you to sign these papers because it's going to be for the best for this child. You know, I didn't understand at 18, 19 years old the words incomprehensible demoralization. I did not understand why I didn't measure up. Why wasn't I good enough? Why me? I blamed you for every single thing that went wrong with me. And I signed those papers. And the baby was born, and I got to hold her for 3 days. Her name was Michelle. And I got to, you know, just what any 18-year-old kid would do, try his best not to look afraid and try to tell this kid it was for the best. And, you know, the last day I got to see this child, it was behind the glass, and it was sleeping, and I came up, and I went to say goodbye. And I'm crying, and I'm crying. I'm saying, dear God, I hope this is the right thing to do. And I'm trying to talk to this kid and let her hear that, you know, I love her. And the kid woke up like she heard me and started crying. It just made me feel worse. You know, and I did that day what I've done my whole life up until then on coping with my struggles. I went to the bar. You know, you could put me in any bar in any city, and within a few minutes, I'm right at home. I've been going to the bar since I was 5 years old. On my way to Yankee Stadium, my father would go in and have an eye-opener. And I didn't know what an eye-opener was. That's a beer and a shot before we got on the train. And then my mother would take me into the bar and sit me in the corner, give me a Coke and potato chips, play some shuffleboard. So I've been going in and out of bars since I was such a young man. I started to drink regularly in a bar when I was 15 years old with a phony identification. And after this just unbelievable moment in my life, the only thing I knew how to do was go to the bar and drown my sorrows. I was a full-blown alcoholic before I was 17 years old. And I'm sitting in the bar angry, and some guy came over and tried to comfort me. And you know what happens when you're drinking and people comfort you? You know, I did some very bad things that night that I regret. And I didn't know what to do. And I stayed in this state of mind for such a long time. See, there was no relief for me. There was no relief for me when I was drinking now, and there was no relief for me when I was sober. Going home, there was still madness in there. I got younger brothers and sisters now that are afraid of everything that's going on. They're trying to do their thing. I have a young sister who I love dearly. We're best friends today, looking for help, trying to get guidance. And, you know, something about that love allowed me just to keep a little of my sanity. In New York City, in the Bronx, you go from neighborhood to neighborhood, and I was pretty well known in my neighborhoods back then. I was a tough guy back then, and there was a youth organization called the Northwest Bronx Community Coalition. And there was a young woman in there who just started a youth part of it was to organize youths. And she heard about me, and she goes, you know, I heard about you. It seems like you have leadership skills. I'd like to give you a job as a youth organizer. Now, by then, my hair is all the way down on my shoulders. I'm going on with a red bandana. I got 6 court cases pending against me, and I said, are you sure you got the right guy? She goes, your name is out here. I watch what you do. You have leadership skills. Do you want a job? And it was the first time in my life that somebody said something nice about me. See, my whole life, I knew I had potential. I was told I had potential. I was told, why do you do those things? Why can't you do this? Why? And I wish I could have looked them in the eye and told them, I don't know. I don't know why when I take a drink, the drink takes me, and I don't care what the consequences are. See, I always know there was consequences to my drinking. I know when I take a drink, something's going to happen. But yet I take it anyway. And I take the other one and the next one and the next one. And I don't care the consequences. And I lived that way for such a long time, not caring about what was going to happen. But this woman, she really helped me. Her name was Peggy. We're still friends today. And I got this job, and she started talking about, you know, you dropped out of high school. You want to go back and get your GED? I said, really? How do you do that? And she showed me, and she started giving me some tools. I'm still drinking, but I'm not drinking as much. I'm still partying. I'm not partying as much. And all of a sudden, my life started to just take shape a little bit. Somebody showed a little interest in me. And for that year, you know, I thrived. I organized football leagues and basketball leagues. I got all these kids to stop beating each other up and start playing sports together. Guys were going to jail. Now they're getting their GEDs with me. It was really one of the greatest moments and a turning point in my life. Cut my hair. And after that 1 year, that job was over because it was a city job. And, you know, the director liked me. And he goes, look, John, the city job is over, but I have an aunt who works in shipping. And there's a mailroom position open. Would you like it? I said, sure. And I got a job working in Lower Manhattan in a mailroom for a shipping line at 19 years old. And, you know, now I have to dress up. And I'm still drinking. I've still got all these problems. But I'm not getting arrested right now. I'm not getting in trouble as much. I'm still drinking. I'm still partying. But I have a little bit of hope. I have a little bit more money in my pocket. And I'm starting to feel just a little bit better about myself. But, of course, you know, that doesn't last. You know, I get this job and I go down to Battery Park at lunchtime, smoking a couple of joints at lunchtime, having a beer, the Blarney Stone, two beers and a sandwich for $3. That was my lunch every single day. And, you know, I just started coping, thinking about my life. And when I was in, at this job, it was, you know, I got promoted after a year or after 6 months, and I started working in documentation, and I met this girl on the phone. And this girl lived in California. She did the same job I did and was making, like, I don't know, two times more money than I was. And we became friends on the phone. And after a while, I like to talk a lot of smut. I got to tell you, you put me on the phone back then, and I'm talking crap because, see, I'm a user of people. I need you to make me feel good. I know that there was a woman out there that was going to fill that hole inside me. And I jumped from relationship to relationship to relationship, looking for you to fix me, looking for you to make me happy. It took thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in marriage counseling for that man to tell me it is not my wife's job to make me happy. I was totally disappointed when I learned that, to be honest with you. But the truth of the matter is, that's how I thought. I was a taker. I wasn't a giver. I'm a charmer. I'll say anything and do anything to get what I want from you. And I have this relationship now going on the phone. And one night I got into another beef, another altercation, and I got put in front of the judge. And the judge said, you know, John, if I see you again, you're going away to 3 to 5 years. I said, Your Honor, you're never going to see me again. I'm moving to California. And 2 weeks after my 21st birthday, I bought a one-way ticket to California. Now, I will tell you, before I got here, I talked to this gal. She goes, oh, you need to come out. And she sent me a picture, blonde hair, blue eyes, big boobs, cut up to here, holding a rose. I'm like, oh, my God, unbelievable. And I got my Polaroid out, and I was taking these action photos for her to make sure I got my best side. You know, I must have took like 20 of them before I finally sent one. So physically, we thought we liked each other. But I will tell you, that woman had no idea what a lunatic she was getting, you know. And I bought a one-way ticket, because that's what I do. I'm giving everything up, because I know that my real problem is if I got to get out of that Bronx. If I just got out of the Bronx, my life will get better. If I just got out of my neighborhood, if I just got out of the bar, if I just got out of the foggy dew, which I lived in every day almost, if I just got out of my neighborhood, it'd be fine. And I told my mother I was moving to California, and she was really surprised, but I think a little happy, because in some way she saw herself leaving Ireland to come to New York to get a better life, and she knew that if I would have stayed, I probably would have wound up in jail. And I'll say on a side note, you know, every time I got arrested, my mother got me out of jail. And for some reason, she always took me for Chinese food, which to this day I never understood. That was kind of like, it's okay, hon. You know, it's okay. You're going to be okay. You know, I remember sitting, my mother, who, again, I love more than life, sitting telling me, you know, one day you're going to be somebody. Don't give up on yourself. You're a good man. You're a good boy, John. You know, you're a good boy. And I'm like, Mom, you don't understand. I'm not. You don't know half the things I do. I'm not proud. I do it to survive. It's just the way it is. But for some reason, that woman, even in her alcoholism, always believed in me. And she said always, if the day I left, you're going to take your cup and saucer with you, you know. And she took me to the airport, and she brought that stupid cup and saucer, you know. She gives me the cup, and she goes, I'm going to keep the saucer. You're always welcome home. And, of course, as a mother and as a son, you start crying. And I got on that plane, and I had a few drinks on the plane, and I'm coming out to California, and I'm showing everybody this photo of this beautiful girl that I'm going to go out here and meet. My life's going to be great. She was going to pick me up in a limo and do obscene things to me in the limo and have champagne. It was going to be fabulous. And I get here, and I'm looking around for my girl, and some other woman showed up.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
She didn't send me the other half of her picture because she forgot to tell me about the other 200 pounds that was below her waist. So once again, here I am with this incomprehensible demoralization going, how do you do this shit, John? How does this happen to you? Poor me, poor me. It wasn't poor me. I jumped at the opportunity for somebody to take care of me one more time. I jumped at the opportunity. And I will tell you with all honesty, I may not have gotten what I thought, but she didn't get what she thought either. I'm a 21-year-old lunatic. I am a lunatic. You know, we just had a step study at my house with my guys that I sponsor. And one of the questions was, did you ever think you were crazy? Did you ever think you were crazy? We went out in a room, and you know, when I was a kid, people said I was crazy. But I never felt I was crazy. The more you thought I was crazy, the more I acted that way because I wanted your attention. And after a while, I would start doing crazy things because I wanted you to like me. You know? But when I came out here, this woman knew within a couple of days that I was crazy. Because I never paid a bill, I thought I knew everything, I had $800 to my name, and I can't tell anybody what's going on. I can't tell everybody, she's not exactly what I wanted. So I went to her house, she picked me up in the limo, we did those things in the limo, I got to her house, I called my mother, she goes, is everything okay? I go, yeah. She goes, what's wrong? Is she fat? And all I can hear is my mother laughing her ass off at me. Ha, 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 ha. And I didn't know what to do. I had no relatives, no nothing. I do everything to the extreme. And so I would sit on the beach drinking rum and cokes, writing letters to my buddies, putting sand in, saying, what a great life I got. Can't get a job. I don't know how to drive. No driver's license. No nothing. But within 10 days, we realized, this girl and I, that we were not compatible. And I got a job. And I worked pretty quick because after 2 days in a job, I met a girl in a job. And her and I got along really well. And by the third day, she asked me to move in, and I said yes. I'm 21 years old, full of crap, scared out of my mind, and don't know how to deal with it except to take a drink, to take that edge off, and to become something that I created. You know, I walked around this whole world for such a long time with this false sense of ego, this egomaniac that I created to hide that fear. I created an image that I wanted you to know, and that image was nothing of who I really was. But that's all I knew how to do. All I knew how to do was to be something I thought you wanted me to be, and then I started to behave like that. I started to believe my own BS over and over and over, because the only thing coming out of my mouth was BS. But this gal and I, we got along really well. And that first year in California was probably everything that I dreamed. She was beautiful, she was smart, and we had a great time. And at Christmas time, my mother called and she goes, I want you to come home for Christmas. I said, Mom, I'm not coming home for Christmas. You know, I was mad at her because she didn't send me some money that I asked for. And I said, I'm going up to San Francisco to meet my girlfriend's parents. However, I will give you a call after New Year's. And with that being the spiteful man that I was, despite the love that that woman had for me, I got on a plane to San Francisco. When I came home, there was a note on my door and it said, please call home. It was an emergency. And I knew my father died. I knew that SOB finally kicked the bucket. And, you know, I didn't really have any feelings for that. And when I called home, I found out that my mother died. She was 46 years old. She had a heart attack in her sleep. She actually drank herself to death. The disease of alcoholism took over. She couldn't take it anymore. And I feel she gave up. You know, it was very shocking to me because, you know, my whole life now, I'm starting to get my life together. And I get on a plane saying goodbye to this girl because I knew I'm the eldest. I got to go back and take care of things. And I went back home and I saw my mother in a coffin. And I will tell you that I believed in every fiber in my soul that that was the way I was going to die. I knew that my life was going to be short and I was going to make the most of it. It didn't matter what I did. I had no idea how the disease of alcoholism worked. I had no idea that if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. I had no idea that drinking was holding me back from everything I ever wanted to be. And when I got off that plane, I went to that mortuary, I saw her, and I stayed drunk for the next 3 months back there. I did not draw a sober breath. And after the third month, and I will tell you that the disease of alcoholism is a family disease. And it had so much of a profound effect on our family that when my mother died, the best thinking that my brothers and sisters had was to put a half a pint of vodka in her casket in case she woke up and needed a drink. Because that's all we ever saw. That's what we saw. And it doesn't make sense today, but when you're 21 years old or you're 18 years old or you're 12 years old, it makes sense. For the next 3 months, you know, I caused a lot of havoc back there. You know, I was starting to get back into my old behavior. And my brother came up to me and goes, you know, man, you seemed a lot happier when you were in California. Why don't you call that girl and see if she'll take you back? And I called her. I said, listen, I'd like to come back. She goes, I love you. Please come back. And I came back. And, you know, I got on that plane again. And this time, though, it was really different because I knew something happened to me. And I didn't know what it was. I knew there was a change in me, and I really believed that my destiny was to die a young man because my behavior, my actions, everything that I did in my life was causing me to believe that I would not live a long life. And I got on that plane, and you know that girl who I loved dearly, you know, I came back and I was a horrible man. You know, for the next 3.5 years, I cheated on her, spent her credit cards, you know, didn't come home, drank in the bar, and she didn't understand why. And I didn't know what to tell her. I wanted to tell her, honey, I don't know. I don't know why this happens. And I broke her heart. But, you know, I'm already making plans for my next escape, my next victim. I already got her on the hook. She's been on the hook now for 28 years, so it was a pretty good bait I had at that time. But, you know, I started to see this other woman, and she drank like I did. She was beautiful, smart, you know, everything about her. And I moved out of that relationship, and I moved into my own place. And within, you know, 3 or 4 months, we started dating. And, you know, within 5 months, I moved in with her, you know. And this was different because she drank like I did. She partied like I did. And, you know, it was a great relationship. And, you know, after about 6 or 8 months, she goes, you know, I want to get married. I go, okay. Let's go back. We go back to New York to introduce her to my family. And, you know, she came back pregnant with our daughter, Jessica. And, you know, my wife and I today, you know, when we were dating, Friday night was our night. You know, we went out. And this Friday came along. She's pregnant. And she's like, you know, I go, all right, Friday night, where are we going? She goes, what do you mean where we're going? I'm pregnant, stupid. We're not going anywhere. And you would think that I would have been grateful to have that second opportunity to be a father again. But see, when I need to take a drink, I need to go. And I said, well, look, honey, I'm sorry you can't do it, but I'll be back in a couple of hours. And if you drink like I do, it's never a couple of hours. When you drink the way I drink, when you take a drink, that drink takes me, and it takes me places that I'm not very proud of. And over the course of that pregnancy, that woman had to come into bars and drag me out of bars. And I'm not proud of that. And our daughter Jessica was born. And my daughter Jessica was born on March 31st, 1987. And I thank God for the second chance to be a father. And for a little while, you know, having that daughter was a big deal for me. You know, I started to change my behavior a little bit, try to be home, try to be helpful. And, you know, nobody told the father that when your first baby comes into this world, that there's not a lot of room for you. It's for you and the baby. And I am a self-centered, egotistical maniac who needs a lot of attention. And over the first 3 months, I wasn't getting it, so I was back out drinking, you know, doing the very best I could with the tools that I had. And then I started to get a job, and I started to get involved with what I call as my special effects, and that's those extracurricular activities we do to enhance our drinking. And I started to do a lot of special effects. You know, I was working this company, and I'd give this company some business, and they in turn would give me those drugs, and now I'm becoming a full-blown drug addict again. And one night at 4 o'clock in the morning, wired out of my head, a TV show comes on and says, do you have a drug and drinking problem? Call 1-800-HELP-ME. And I call that number up, and that jackass was there the next day. They do not. When they got a big fish on the hook, they're going to reel you in quickly. And I was a big fish. And I went into that rehab place thinking, you know, 30 days, and I'm a quick talker, and I'm a quick learner, and I'm BS, and I'm talking fast, and I'm trying to figure out the lay of the land, because I'm going to get this and I'm going to be fine. And you know, I did. I stayed in for 30 days. And I realized that, you know, I'm a drug addict. I'm never going to do drugs again. And I got out of that hospital, and I went to my sister-in-law's house, go to the fridge, crack open a Budweiser, take a sip, look at my wife, whose eyes are bulging out of her head. I'm not even out of the hospital 2 hours, and I look at her and say, honey, our problems are over. I'm never going to do drugs again. And I want you to know I meant that with every fiber of my soul. You know, I had my first drunk driving when I was 21 years old. And I thought it was a fluke, bad luck, you know, not a big deal. The next time I got pulled over, 2 days later, I got pulled over again and got away with it. 4 years later, I got my second drunk driving, 2 days before Christmas, you know. Can you imagine that Christmas? Horrible. And within a couple of months after coming out of that hospital, to make a long story short, you know, I went back to my drinking. I didn't do any drugs, but my drinking got worse and worse and worse. And one of our friends that used to drink with us said, you know, John, I'd like you to come to Alcoholics Anonymous with me. And because the pressure was on at home, I decided to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been told about Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been kind of in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous with these drunk drivings. But, you know, you guys were giving me a solution to a problem that I yet was able to admit that I had. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you to this meeting tonight and hope that you get it. Because it took me a very long time before I admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And you kept giving me the solution to a problem, but I could not identify because I did not believe I had it. And I kept coming in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was told when I went to this meeting this one time with this woman, they said, don't drink, get a sponsor, sit down, shut up, and listen. And I said, F you, F you, F you. I did the exact opposite of what they told me. I didn't get a sponsor. I raised my hand. I spewed out whatever crap was on my mind that day. They got so sick of hearing me, they didn't call them anymore. So I would just get up and start sharing anyway because I realized that I had a lot to say. And after 1 year of sobriety, instead of taking an anniversary like we do here, I went home, looked in the mirror and said, I told you you couldn't be an alcoholic. There's no way you could have stayed sober for a year. And I stopped going to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And within three months, I was back drinking full blown again. And I stayed that way for the next 8 years. And I can only tell you the 8 years of what was going on. It was horrible. You know, I lost every single job I ever had before I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I screwed up every single relationship that I had before I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now, if my wife could have killed me and got away with it, the judge would have let her go as a mercy killing. You know, my daughter was afraid of her father. The girl that I love with all my soul, I would be coming home and my wife would be so angry with me, she wouldn't even be in the room. You know, and I created so much chaos, but yet I didn't know what to do. I knew I was stuck. I didn't know how to get unstuck. See, I didn't have any principles now. You know, I did not have any morals. What I was doing was just feeling good for that moment. All I needed to do was feel good for that moment. That's all I knew how to do. And on March 9th, 1995, I got my third drunk driving, the second one within 3 months. And it wasn't really that bad. If I knew that was my last night of drinking, I probably would have done a little better with it. You know, I went out, I had about six or seven white Russians, you know, I was feeling a little buzz. I came home to get more money because, you know, my MO was, honey, I'll be home at 7. I'd call her at 7. I'll be home at 8. I'll be home at 9. After 10, I stopped calling because I know she's just getting madder. And I went to get more money and the police saw me swerve and they threw me in jail. And I'm sitting on the curb with a pair of handcuffs on me again one more time. And that's when I had my moment of clarity. And that's when I realized that you were right and I was wrong. You see, I fought for my right to drink my whole life. I fought to be able to keep the one thing that I thought was my best friend. I fought to keep that booze flowing in me because I did not like the way I felt unless I was drinking. And that moment, I knew without a reasonable doubt that I was an alcoholic. And you old timers that get these new guys that come in, I want to encourage you to keep giving those phone numbers out. Because when I was coming in out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a man named Alan Rosenkranz, who I love, he was my sponsor, and he gave me his number. And for 6 months, I would tell my wife, you know, honey, I'm going to call that man one day, I'm going to call that man one day, and I'd sober up and put it in the drawer and I would forget about it. But when I got out of jail that night, I called that man up. I said, my name is John Brown, and I think I'm an alcoholic. And he says, good. Come see me tomorrow. And I went to go meet him. And I told him my story. And he asked me a question that I never forgot. He goes, John, are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober? And I would have said yes to anything that day. He goes, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go to meetings every single day, no matter what. We're going to show up early. We're going to stay late. We're going to sit up front. We're going to hang out with the winners and get involved with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go, great. He goes, I'll see you tomorrow at 7 a.m. I go, 7 a.m.? I don't wake up till noon on Saturdays. And thus the first name of Jackass became into my vocabulary. Look, you jackass, you just made a commitment. So at 7:15, because I show up to meetings late and I leave early, you know, and that, when I met that man, Alan Rosenkranz, there was another man named by the name of Bob Braglin. And Bob Braglin had about 35 years. And if you don't think remembering somebody's name in a meeting is important, let me tell you how much it is. Because I showed up to that meeting 15 minutes late, and I stood in the back of the room. And in the middle of the room, he got up and yelled, John, come sit next to me. And that slight little gesture that Bob Braglin gave me made me feel that I was part of Alcoholics Anonymous. The fact that he remembered my name, the fact that he had a seat for me. And for the next 5 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bob Braglin, we'd go around and introduce myself. And he would go, good morning, John. And I would say, good morning, Bob. And it was a little joke between us. And when he died, I missed that man. Because that man made me, he was the first man to ever make me feel welcome in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to encourage you to continue to reach your hands out. Give those phone numbers. Go out and remember somebody's name. Make them feel that they're part of. You have no idea the power that we have when somebody new to make them feel that they belong. We all feel that we belong. We have a responsibility to make other people feel that they belong as well. And I'm now going to meetings. And, you know, my wife is now even more pissed off at me because now I'm going to meetings in the morning and I'm going to meetings at night. And after about, I'm going to 2 meetings a day, 7 days a week because I'm a real sick alcoholic. And about after a month, she goes, you know, I wish you'd drink again. I go, what? She goes, at least you were home. And once again, confused. Don't you know what I'm doing? Don't you know what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to save our marriage and blah, blah, blah. You know, the martyr comes out 30 days and I'm a martyr all over again, you know? And I go to my sponsor. He goes, God damn it, my wife, my wife, my wife. He goes, John, do you remember every lie you ever told your wife? I said, no, she does. How many times you didn't show up? Nope, she does. Do you? I go, no. He goes, then shut the hell up and prove it. 6 months, still struggling. We go to marriage counseling because I really don't want to leave my marriage. And I go to this marriage counselor, and I'm 6 months sober now. I'm freaking, I know what I'm doing. You know, my life is good now, all right? I'm really good. I got all the answers. Go to this marriage counselor, pay him $100-something, and we sit down, and she spews about what a jackass I am. I spew what a lovely pain in the butt she is. And we leave. Go back the next week, you know, nothing got accomplished. He gives a couple of tools that we don't understand. She spews about me. I spew about her. The third time he comes in, he goes, look, I am so tired of this. I can't help you. What do you mean you can't help us? I can't help either one of you. What does that mean? You can't come back anymore. I'm sorry. Are you throwing me out of marriage counseling? Yes. You son of a bitch! Mr. Brown, I'm calling the police. I could not believe that we were so crazy. And this is what the disease of alcoholism will do to you. It'll make you crazy. We got out of that council. We looked at each other in shock. And the next thing you know, we started cracking up. It was the first lighthearted moment that we've had in such a long, long time. She went to Al-Anon for a little while. I went back to my AA meetings. And, you know, life started to take a little bit of a new meaning. Excuse me. You know, I got to take those steps. You know, I didn't understand that. I knew that I might have drank a little too much, but I didn't understand that my life was unmanageable. I came here with a tie on, and I had a house, and, you know, I had a wife and a kid, and, you know, my sponsor was great. He goes, you know, John, most people whose life is manageable aren't going to jail on the weekends for drunk driving, aren't in debt, and doesn't have their wife that wants to kill them. Can you understand how your life might be a little unmanageable? I said, I do. And I started to take these steps. And, you know, one of the biggest steps that I had to take was my fourth step. And, you know, and that fourth step was an amends to my mother. And my mother's been dead for 16 years. And I didn't even put her down as a resentment because, you know, I just didn't understand. And as having a good sponsor who knows how to kind of get that out of you, and we started to talk about this resentment. And I realized I had a huge resentment towards my mother. I always believed it was about my father, but it was really more about my mother. And I had to write this letter to her to ask her to forgive me for not being the best son. And I started to write this letter, and it started, "Dear Mom." And as soon as "Dear Mom" came, the tears started flowing. And I talked to her all the time. I stole money out of her purse, and all the times I got arrested, and the times I got kicked out of school, and every single thing that I can remember that I did, I wrote down. And it was about 3 pages. And by the time I was finishing that third page, I was sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And I called my sponsor. I said, "I finished." And I read it to him. He goes, "All right, John, you can get on with your life." I go, "You don't understand. I feel horrible." He goes, "I do understand. It's going to be okay." And the reason Monday night Seal Beach Speaker is my home group, because the format is 2 7-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. And nobody knew what I did that day except me and God and my sponsor. And the secretary at that meeting saw me and she said, "You're going to be our 7-minute speaker tonight." And in front of 250 people, I got to share that story about that. And I got up on this podium like I am today and I started to share my story and I started crying. And by the time I was finished, I was sobbing. And when I came down, they put their arms around me. They said, "John, it's going to be okay." And I want you to know, it was the very first time in my life that I believed it. It was the very first time in my life that I believed that my life was going to be okay. And it's because I started to take contrary action to what I've done. Alcoholics Anonymous works 100% of the time. We're the ones that screw it up. I just have to follow direction. I just have to do the work and let God take care of the results. I know today that I am not in the results business. I am in the acceptance business. As Ruth talked about today, I have to leave the results up to God. I had no idea what a control freak that I was and how I was always so afraid and trying to do all these things. And when I started to let go and let you in, when I started to believe that this could work for me, my life started to change. This broken down high school dropout who was no good started to get a little bit better. You know, I tried to make that amends to my dad, who was now living in California. And, you know, it didn't work very well with him. You know, I went to make an amends to him, and I said, "You know, Dad, I'm really sorry for not being a son, but, man, you were a bad father. And if you're new, that is not the right way to make an amends." And I was unable to make an amends to that man for a very, very long time. But my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a process. I think we get it here when we're new, and we get this energy, and we're Captain AA, we're doing all this crap, we're everywhere, we're volunteering, we're doing this, we got commitments, and then we start getting some stuff in our lives. And slowly but surely, we start to fade away. "I got it. I don't need to show up to that potluck again. I don't need to sell those raffles for central office. I'm busy, I'm a father now, I'm this and that." And, you know, I honestly believe that our journey goes highs and lows. And fortunately, I had a sponsor who would not put up with my crap. I remember calling him up. I was about a year and a half sober. I said, "Alan, I'm having a bad day." He goes, "Really, John, what's wrong?" I said, "My wife's being a, you know what, my job sucks, and I don't know what to do." He goes, "Wow, would you like me to come over?" I go, "Yeah, that'll be great." He goes, "I'll bring my gun. You can blow your effing brains out." And he hung the phone up on me. Nobody talked to me that way. Are you kidding? 5 minutes later, he calls me back. He goes, "John, I don't care how you feel. I only care what you're doing. Because if you want to change how you feel, change what you're doing." Man, those are words that I live by today. If I want to change how I feel, change what I'm doing. I'm sorry, that's a little too easy. My life is a little bit more complicated. I need a better solution. You know, and he said, "Why don't we try God, John?" You know, when I was taking those steps, I was afraid of God because I knew that God was the only person that knew everything about me. And I didn't know how to know. I did not know that we start to get forgiven when we start to forgive. When we start to take this process and to forgive, real or imagine, the people that hurt us, when we start to forgive the people that we put on our fourth steps and make those amends, when we start to look at our fears, when we start to realize that most of us have been afraid because we've been alone most of our lives because we didn't allow God in our lives. And all it takes is two words, dear God, to allow that man in our lives. And it took me a while to start understanding it, you know. And, you know, I was a smoker. And I tried Nicorette, Dicorette, Licorette, you name it, I tried it. I couldn't stop smoking. And Alan would go, hey, how much you spend on those patches today? I go, $50. He goes, you should have gave it to me. I can help you. I go, you can't help me. 2 weeks go by. Where are you going? I'm going to get hypnotized. How much is that? $100. Give me half of it. I'll help you. I go, Alan, you can't help me on this one. I'm telling you. So after like 4 months, I'm frustrated. I'm still smoking. And he goes, are you ready? All right. What do I have to do? He goes, every time you're about to light a cigarette, say, dear God, help me not smoke today. And that's it, jackass. Just say, dear God, help me not smoke today. And freaking that's it. I go, this is why you drive me crazy. He goes, why don't you try it? Okay. Every time I said, dear God, help me smoke, I felt like I had to smoke 3 in a row because it was going to strike me dead, right? I'm just crazy. 6 months, I'm smoking every day. Dear God, help me not smoke. This ain't working. Lake Tahoe, took a drag. I went, I'm going to quit tomorrow. My wife goes, oh, sure. Because this was my MO of quitting. New Year's Day, I would tell her I'm going to quit tomorrow. I would go through all the ashtrays and throw them out, except leave a couple of butts just in case. Shut the curtains and lay in the floor in a fetal position till 4 o'clock until I was crazy. Run to the garbage, slap the light. Okay, we'll try it tomorrow. That was all my attempts at smoking. That day came, I haven't had a cigarette since in over 12 freaking years, you know? Because when I stop taking my own advice and I trust the process of this higher power, it's absolutely amazing at how good my life could get. You know, it's absolutely amazing when I start to trust the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started a little business in sobriety, and I told you I got fired from every single job I ever had. But, you know, I was pretty good at myself. You know, I was pretty good at what I did. I was a sales guy, and, you know, I'm personable, so I make relationships. I'm 2.5 years sober, and, you know, I was working for a company, and they weren't treating me very well. They were treating their employees really bad. My sister worked with me. So I, you know, I called my sponsor. He said, you know, I'm getting beat up in my company. He goes, well, did you cause some of these problems? I said, I did. He goes, look, John, we never quit when we're down. You only quit when you're on top. What I want you to do, I want you to work and get back on top and show the guy why you're in this position. I said, you don't understand. This guy is beating me up. He's blaming me. He goes, John, you caused some of these problems. You know, and I took his advice. And I worked my butt off for the next year and a half. And when the time came, not only by taking that advice, not only was I ready to open my own business, I had the money, the revenue, I did. I quit. The guy said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to start my own business. He goes, ah, you stupid American. Good luck. And I started this little shipping company. And that first week, I was absolutely out of my mind, full of fear. You know, people were supposed to come in. They didn't come in. This money didn't come in, blah, 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 blah. And on that Friday, I got on my knees in front of my desk. And I said, dear God, if you do not want me to do this, I fully understand. But I cannot go through another week. Please show me what you want me to do. And I left that office. And I didn't think about work that weekend. I came to work on Monday. And from that to now, which has been 15 years, my phones have not stopped ringing. How does that happen? You know, how does that happen in this world? How is it when I stop running the show and I start trusting in a power greater than myself, when I start to believe that doing the right thing in this world is all that we need to do to have a good life, when I start to think that it's, when I start to put my life in caring about you more than me, my sponsor said, you know, John, if you had $5 and I was hungry and you were hungry, you need to feed me first. Because when you go to get, you get nothing. But when you go to give, you get tenfold. And I believed him. And I've tried to live that life for the last almost 19 years of my sobriety. I tried to be the man that my mother knew I was going to be. I tried to be that man that I used to make fun of as a kid, being a young schmuck in the Bronx, all right? I tried to be that guy that goes to work on time, shows up, does what he says he's going to do. And most important, I'm proud to be a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous most of the time. You guys have given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. Beyond my wildest dreams. That daughter, you know, I'll share a couple of quick stories before I finish, but, you know, we were probably 9 years married. I got sober when we were 9 years married. We were probably 15, 16 years married. We were having some problems, you know, as marriages do. And I went to marriage counseling. Our daughter was about to go to college, and, and she goes, "Why are you here?" The marriage counselor. I said, "Well, you know, I don't know if I want to stay married. I'm unhappy." She goes, "Really?" So we talk. She goes, "Why don't you do me a favor? Why don't you ask God to show you why you're married?" And, you know, all these marriage counselors, I don't get it with this God stuff. And paying them money to ask you to pray is really amazing. So for 2 weeks, I went home and said, "Dear God, show me why I'm married. Dear God, show me why I'm married. Show me why I'm married. Show me why I'm married." And then I stopped. And then the week later, we went on our first real vacation in a long time. We went to Hawaii. And we had this unbelievable time. And we come back to the marriage counselor. She goes, "How'd it go?" "Oh, my God, I'm gushing. We had this great time." She goes, "Well, you got your answer." I go, "What answer?" She goes, "Didn't you pray?" I go, "Pray about what?" She goes, "You left here. You were supposed to pray to ask God to show you." I said, "Oh, shit. I did." And then these wonderful words came out of her mouth. "Isn't God's plan better than yours?" If I had my way, I would have left that marriage because I was so ashamed of my behavior. And I was so broken inside, I didn't know if it was ever going to be fixed. And I know today that if I would have left that marriage, that my daughter probably would have been so angry at her father that she probably would have not done the things she did, or she probably would not have accomplished. My daughter was the first one in our family to ever graduate from college. And I got to thank you for that. Because if I would have done what I wanted to do and leave and run away, because, you know, it's really tough to continue to face those mistakes over and over and over. It took almost 5 years before my wife believed that maybe I was going to change. That's a long time. But, you know, it needed every moment of that time to build that trust back, because I broke that trust. And in September of this year, we'll be married 28 years. And it didn't come easy. And I don't think any relationship comes easy. I think you have to continue to work at these relationships and realize that we're human beings and that we're still growing as people. I can tell you, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the reason why I am so on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous today at 53 years old is because I know that I'm only scratching the surface of what kind of man I can be. I know that if I continue to trust God and do the things that I watch you do. See, my sponsor, Alan, not only told me what to do, he showed me what to do. He showed me how to be a good man. He showed me how to show up. He showed me how to get involved. He showed me how to care for other people. The men that I sponsor today, I show them how to show up. I show them how to care about other people. I show them how to get involved. Because there's a lot of arguing telling people, "Do what I say, not what I do." You can't argue with you. Do what I do. My life's just been so great. So I'm going to end on this note because it's one of the most important things in my sobriety. I told you that this father of mine, who I hated, I tried to make this amends to him, you know, and it didn't work. And about 3 years later, he hurt his leg, and he was back in New York, and it turned out the leg got infected. It turned into gangrene, and they had to operate on the 70-year-old man. They said, "You know, your father's probably not going to make the operation. If you want to see him, you need to come back." And I called my sponsor, and I said, "You know, I don't know how to feel about this." And he called his sponsor, who was Frank Honeycutt at the time, and Frank said, "You know, John, you need to pray for God's will." And I'm like, "Really? Is that the best you got? I mean, I'm hurting here. This is. I mean, really? This is 30 years of the best you got?" And, of course, my nickname came back up. "Listen, jackass, shut up. Do what you're told." I go, "How do you do that?" "Dear God, whatever your will is from my father, you'll accept it." I got on the plane. All I can say is, dear God, whatever your will is, whatever your will is." And I got to his bedside. They cut his leg off. He had a respirator on. He was detoxing from cigarettes and booze. And, you know, they said he probably wasn't going to get out. And I sat by his bedside with my brothers and sisters. And the only thing I can say is, "Dear God, whatever your will is, whatever your will." And about a week later, he woke up out of this coma. And another week later, they took the respirator out, and I got to take him home. And over those 2 weeks, something really, really strangely happened, because for the very first time in my life, I was the son, and he was the father. And the healing process of Alcoholics Anonymous is amazing. Because over the next 5 years, me and this man became best friends. I took him to ball games. We sang Frank Sinatra songs in the car. He came with me when I spoke. And we just had this fantastic relationship. And he lived with my sister. And my sister said, you know, your father's not feeling well. You need to go get him. Take him to the doctor. And I said, okay. I pick him up. I go, hey, Pops, how you doing? He goes, all right. We're talking. He looks at me. He goes, you know, I love you. I said, wow, I love you too. He says, I'm proud of you. Words that I've longed for my whole life from him, but I didn't deserve it from him because I didn't treat him well. I said, thank you, Dad. I got him into the car. I got him into the hospital. He died like 6 minutes later. And I knew when he died, him and I was all right because of you. Because of you, listening to how to make those amends, how to bridge the gap, how to get out of my own way, how to love people in your life. Because of you, when he died, him and I were good. And I will tell you, that is the biggest gift that I've ever gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be able to know that I'm okay. To be able to know that what you have done through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, through meetings, and to great sponsorship, you've turned me into the man that I am today. And for that, I'll be forever grateful. Thank you.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.